Hey everybody, Luke here, and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Q is currently traveling, so I've stepped in with today's intro. For today's episode, Q is joined by John Larkey, Senior Vice President of Power Marketing at National Grid Renewables. If you've ever wondered how large-scale renewable energy projects secure financing, navigate power markets, and manage risk, this episode is for you. John has been in the energy space for over 15 years, transitioning from engineering and power trading into power marketing, where he helps bring wind, solar, and storage projects to life. In this conversation, they cover how power marketing works, from securing long-term contracts to managing exposure in volatile electricity markets. They also dive into how corporate power buyers are reshaping the market, the rapid growth of data center demand, and why co-location is becoming such a critical strategy in the U.S. grid. What really stuck with me from this episode is how the role of power marketers has evolved. It's not just about securing contracts anymore. It's about understanding fuel markets, transmission bottlenecks, and the second-order effects of locational pricing. So, where does power marketing go next? As corporate buyers get more sophisticated, data center demand surges, and transmission constraints tighten, are we seeing a fundamental shift in how renewable projects are structured? We'd love to hear your thoughts in the comments. And if you're enjoying Transmission, please hit subscribe. It really helps us to reach more listeners and bring more great conversations like this one to you. All right, let's jump in.
Hey, John, it's been a long time. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Q. Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
So, power marketing. Let's get straight to it. You do power marketing at National Grid Renewables. What is power marketing?
Sure. So, power marketing, as a broad definition, I consider myself a recovering engineer and a recovering power trader. So, I've been in the power marketing space for about 15 years. When you think about power marketing role, we look at everything from long-term 25-year contracts to secure revenue to build large infrastructure projects, whether it be a thermal generation, wind or solar, to medium-term and shorter-term activities where you're really managing risk in the volatile power markets. So broadly speaking, power marketing covers, you know, a wide range of activities from trading to contracting. They really are designed as an asset owner to get projects built and also to manage the risk associated with the commodities associated with those projects. I think the other element to power marketing you'll hear a lot of people talk about and it's part of the ecosystem is in the wholesale markets, the trading and managing of energy risk between load serving entities, intermediaries that provide liquidity, and really making the physical and the financial come together in the electric industry. And so there's a lot that goes into that.
And we should probably clarify, because a lot of our audience are in Europe, and so they know National Grid to be slightly different. So could you just clarify how National Grid and National Grid Renewables fit together?
Yeah, no, it's a good point, Q. It's always good to know your audience. So thinking globally here, so National Grid Renewables, the company I work for today, was actually acquired by National Grid PLC, based in London, in 2019. Prior to 2019, we operated as an independent developer, owner and operator of wind, solar, and storage projects, and became part of the National Grid family in 2019. To your point, National Grid is a large diversified energy company in the UK operating the grid, as well as some of the massive interconnectors between the UK, Benelux, Norway, Denmark, and France, and I think Ireland as well. And National Grid also, maybe new to your audience, also is the largest importer of gas into Europe through the Isle of Grain, which is a facility National Grid owns today. And in the US, in addition to ourselves as a National Grid company, National Grid has several utilities in the New York and New England area that are investor-owned utilities in the power and the gas space. So that's thanks for raising that. It's a good point.
And you mentioned Isle of Grain. I actually think Isle of Grain does not get talked about enough, but maybe we should do another podcast about that incredible site and the history of that place. It's phenomenal.
And has nothing to do with grain.
And yeah. Nothing to do with grain, which is always helpful. How wonderfully English. Okay, so for you as a power marketer, then, what does a transaction look like? Who do you go between? Who do you serve?
Sure. So for as a power marketer, again, as a renewable developer, owner, operator, our activities in the power to marketing space, very early on before projects get built, you need to secure the revenue. And so the activities of power marketing, which often get referred to as origination, signing long-term agreements and getting those in place to secure the financial revenues necessary to pass the investment committee's approval to invest in a project. So on the very front end, power marketing is involved on the contracting of those revenues. I would suggest there's also an aspect of power marketing that's really about the markets themselves. So the analysis of where are we going to build projects, what's the risk, and then that really layers into who are the customers and the types of contracts that you put in place to secure those revenues. So that's kind of early on before a project exists. Once you invest in a project, it takes a few years to get it built, and your power marketing activities at that point, if you have merchant non-contracted positions, you may be exposed to movements in the marketplace that you're managing in the nearer term, looking out 2 or 3 years, if markets move materially one way or the other, that you may look to hedge those positions. And then once you get into operation and managing the assets, then your power marketing activities become, on a daily basis, scheduling and managing that those electrons into the marketplace with those customers and the markets, and managing then any merchant exposure you have, either through differences in volume between your contracts and what you're producing, if you have maintenance, et cetera, or events that don't allow you to have the electrons you expected, as well as anything that's merchant, managing that exposure in the financial markets and bilateral markets. I think the other big piece, most of what we're talking about right now, is around the energy components, which is the probably 70% of the revenue stream. You also have, capacity and ancillary markets and renewable energy credits, which are other attributes that have to be monetized and managed. And so all of those different product streams are part of the broad umbrella of power marketing.
So if you'll forgive me for oversimplifying, but back in the day when we could talk about coal, but let's talk about gas, right? So when gas was dominating the system, for an originator, you had a really complicated job because you had to match gas prices and power prices on these long-term contracts. You had to hedge both. So surely for renewables, the job is half as difficult because you only have to manage the power side, the offtake side, and there isn't a gas element. I'm sure I'm wrong, but tell me why I'm wrong.
I think it's changed. I wouldn't say it's actually gotten easier for some of the reasons you've flagged, and I think it's getting more difficult because it's, especially when you start talking about some of the challenges with batteries and ancillary services. But maybe just a trip down memory lane or history. Back in 1996 in the U.S. under FERC, that's when the markets were deregulated under FERC Order 888. And that's really what opened up the power markets in the United States. Europe's got a different journey in terms of how power markets came to be. But what essentially was happening is the desire was, hey, let's try to make the markets more efficient and not have these vertically integrated utilities. And so we're going to provide access to the transmission system. And at that time, it became then a very, very bespoke market. So it was deregulated, but really the trading was very physical in nature. It was load serving entity or utility A engaging with their neighbors on a physical basis bilaterally to manage and share their resources to balance loads. So it was very physical in nature through the, here in the U.S. in the 1990s. As you got into the 2000s, and to your point, it was very physical. You had to have fuel and managing coal and gas. And then on the power side, it was very physical in nature. As the markets became more liquid and more participants were involved, you started to see the evolution of financial products and be able to settle things financially. And really, that's been the evolution that we're really on to this day. As a power marketer, in most places, your marginal unit is, especially you talk about some of the bigger markets in ERCOT and some of the European markets, your marginal fuel is gas. And actually, as a power trader in the early 2000s, late 90s and 2000s and 2010, we traded more gas than we did power because you were so exposed to what drove the power, marginal power price was gas. And so those markets are still linked. You have to understand what's going on in gas to really understand where the future of power is going. As you've seen the supply stacks change and every market's different, France with their nuclear fleet's very different than, you know, ERCOT Texas, which is gas dominated. But understanding that supply stack and those marginal cost of generation is really what drives prices. And as a market participant, you need to understand at a very deep level, not only for making investments, but also managing that risk near term or even in the spot markets.
So even if you're, I say only in inverted commas here, only managing the offtake of power, you are by proxy taking a view on other underlying markets such as gas, or in Europe, carbon, or whatever next.
Well said, Q. Absolutely. You have to understand, and I studied a business in a graduate level, but really a lot of this is fundamental economics, macroeconomics. Like you have to have an understanding of the supply and demand stacks at a market level basis, and what drives those, the cost of carbon, the unique peculiarities of every market and regulations that drive what those price signals are going to be. On a long-term basis, it might be carbon policy in a particular geography, or it might be a capacity market regime. You have to understand all of those pieces to A, make it a thoughtful investment, and then B, to manage that investment and that risk for the life of the asset.
Let's just get an idea of scale for National Grid Renewables now. What's on you guys' books?
Sure. So we, as I mentioned, we actually started even at pre-National Grid ownership. We started as a wind developer in the Midwest United States, and then evolved into solar and storage. Today, we operate roughly just under 3 gigawatts of wind, solar, and storage. Those assets are predominantly in the organized markets of the Midwest Independent System Operator, commonly known as MISO, the Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland ISO, known as PJM, ERCOT, which is Texas, and then the SPP Power Pool, the Southwest Power Pool. We have some smaller activities as a renewable owner-operator outside of those, a little bit into the Southeast United States and the Mountain West region. But that's kind of where we operate today as a market participant. Thinking more broadly, we have development projects and assets that we see coming forward in the future, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, certainly in those markets, and beyond those as well. And today, to this point, we're focused just in the lower 48 states in the United States. I forgot to mention we're also a storage operator. At this point in time, only in ERCOT, we've got about just under 400 megawatts in operation in the ERCOT marketplace.
So a big chunk of storage as well. And we track you guys all the time at Modo. So yes. National Grid comes up a lot in our office.
Yes, yeah. We've got a couple big projects down there, and you guys do a good job of tracking not only us, but a lot of other folks too, I know.
All right. Can we talk about corporates for a minute? Because the offtake market, if you like, or the power purchase market, or however we want to describe it, the world that you are in has been totally changed by corporates buying power over long periods. And there's a few parts to this. Part of it is the net zero agenda. Part of it is electrification. Part of it is data centers and the growth in compute requirements. So could you just give a broad overview about what's happening with corporate buyers and how they're starting to move this market?
Yeah, no, it's been fascinating, the evolution. If you go back, not even 5 years, the corporate, you know, the market for renewables, it was kind of a few buckets. It was mandated by state or national policies, right? You know, certain mandates were in place, and that's what drove a lot of things. As the cost of renewable technologies has come down, either with or without subsidies, the economics of renewables have become more competitive. And so again, back to that basic thinking of, you know, supply and demand and macroeconomics. As renewables have become more competitive, they become more attractive to a broader set of market participants. To your point, specifically the corporates and in industrial space. A few years ago, they were, when frankly more projects were trying to get built than there was demand in some cases, corporates were in a strong position to actually contract stuff, which was net positive relative to the energy value from day one. And so their approach then was, hey, this is a good hedge to future energy prices. And they have decent leverage. And so they were locking in contracts, you know, some of these basic financial fixed for floating swaps to hedge energy risk and be able to claim additionality and be renewable. And so it was, you know, it was a very financially attractive for corporates that had a good balance sheet and had a bit of a vision to the future and some, you know, sustainability goals. What's happened in the last couple of years, Q, it's kind of crazy. And even in the last year, you know, you've had sort of crosswinds. On the one hand, you've had growing sustainability and scope 1, 2, and 3 emission goals for corporates looking at not only their direct use of carbon, you know, trying to manage their carbon exposure, really driving that through their supply chain. And so you've had some folks very vocally and for all sorts of reasons, you know, economic and other stakeholder reasons, wanting to reduce that footprint, starting to drive that through their supply chains. So on the one hand, increasing demand for renewables in that environment, the economics still looking attractive, some of the subsidies in some cases helping out. You actually had the Ukraine war and how that drove prices and people realizing the real exposure that they had to, frankly, to thermal and saying, well, we've got to do some things. And so they've had that happen and driving the C&I behaviors of how do we do more. And then the last year with the explosion of artificial intelligence and the demands on the hyperscalers and data centers that facilitate that the growth of that, there is a bit of an arms race going on in that whole part of the customer demand, and so while you've had this latent corporate demand, you now have on top of it now the data centers and what they're trying to do, and so that supply and demand imbalance that I referenced about 5 years ago where the CNIs were sort of dictating terms, it's flipped. There isn't enough supply of electrons, whether they're green, blue, purple, pick your color, to meet the demand of the existing CNI. And now on top of it, this additional data center demand. And so it's really creating some interesting dynamics from a market perspective. And, I think the whole industry is trying to work through this. How do we get more electrons onto the grid faster to meet the needs of reliability, sustainability, affordability, and you know, some degree, some level of equitability as well.
So one of the things that's really struck me in the last decade or so is seeing the evolution of the sophistication of power buyers, especially big corporates, whether that is, Netflix, Facebook, Meta, Google, you know, the big ones that get all the attention, but also industrial buyers that you wouldn't really think of that much who are big energy consumers. Over the last 10 years, they used to go to suppliers or they used to go to a middleman, and they've decided now, you know, we can manage this ourselves. We're going to go straight to the generator. I think that's really interesting what the second order impacts are of that change and the way that power and electricity is now really taken seriously as a key input into the business case of any producer of any industrial or commercial entity anywhere, really. So how's the market changing now that the corporates and industrial buyers are going straight to source? What's that done to the market?
No, it's a really good point. And it's funny for, you know, being a little introspective here. How I got into the power markets business was literally because of that. I started as in a refinery in the early 90s in California, and I showed up as a warm body, with an engineering degree at a refinery. And they said, oh, by the way, we have to shut the plant down when the dot matrix printer comes through and it says, we got to shut down. We have this curtailment contract. And if you curtail, you save a couple million dollars a year. I was like, oh, okay, I guess that makes sense. And not realizing that's not what refineries do. But to be, but to be competitive in that market, it was necessary. This was back in the early 90s when PG&E had demand response and you could save a boatload of money on your demand charges. And I remember getting called by the corporate vice president at one point saying, why are you doing this? What the hell? Or why are you shutting the refinery down? And kind of walked through, hey, I just showed up and this is, but I think the point you're raising and what's evolved is as the markets have changed and as technology has evolved and as people are always looking to become more efficient, yes, you can shut a steel plant down. You'd prefer not to, or an aluminum smelter or a packaging facility. How you do that operationally and process, you're a process guy, I imagine. Process-wise, how you do that, you can change because now you get market and price signals that allow you to respond and be more thoughtful about your consumption of energy. It's not just, you just run 24/7 and whatever the price is, because as the markets become more sensitive and have price signals, it allows consumers or industrial consumer behaviors to change. And so whether it be the technologies on being able to shut down certain motors at the very, demand side management level, people can be more thoughtful and more surgical in their use of energy as an industrial user. And because of that, it requires different skills. It's, if they really want to go do this themselves or outsource it to a party that, has to have all the smart meters and the ability to manage the demand of the industrials, you're seeing that those behaviors change and how people operate change. I think just to continue and then I'll pause here. You're starting to see the same thing at these virtual power plants on the power side as well, where people can sort of aggregate across various small generators to look like a full power plant. And so you're seeing the technologies, evolution and connectivity of managing assets, and whether it be demand or low or generation, and the markets, you need the market signal, price signals and the rules to be there, but you're seeing that evolution change how people can operate.
John, just to talk about that for a second. Now, I don't know this for sure, but I get the impression you've been around a bit longer than me. Right. And well, I was still a baby when you're talking about selling demand response in the 90s. But my point is, so I used to work at a demand side response company before Modo, and I loved it. It was brilliant. But it was like the Wild West. We used to go around and speak to big industrial customers and say, hey, you're using loads of power, we're gonna help you save some and we'll split the difference, right? And I share your sentiment for DSR. I think DSR did a lot to educate industrial and commercial and corporates on their energy use and figure out, it made it important to them, hey, we need to be thinking about electricity usage a bit more. So hats off to DSR for that. But the reason why I raise this is that even in my short existence in this space, in the last kind of decade and a half, there was the term general flexibility. We had virtual power plants. We had aggregators, we had demand side response. We now have edge. So something edge, I heard. Edge is back in vogue now, 10 years later. After everyone was talking about edge 10 years ago, it's edge. Everyone's talking about edge again. It's fine.
It's like bell bottoms, and everything else are coming back.
Yeah. And then, of course, optimizers is the new thing. And so all of these terms describe businesses or things that were too early, I think, personally. I think if you were doing demand side response in the noughties, you're probably too early, right? The regulations and metering and all of the other stuff just haven't caught up. And so the question is, you've been looking at this thing for a while, and every time this kind of gets revamped with a different name, but it's the same kind of principle. Do you think that the time is now for flexibility and demand side response? Or do you still think it's too early?
No, it's a really good point, and I think you're absolutely correct in terms of the maybe being a little early for its time. In terms of now, I think it's different, and here's why. Again, back to the economic drivers. Renewables as a standalone, they're the lowest cost electron. Full stop. Wind, solar in most places on the planet, from just an electron basis, it's the lowest cost. The challenge, so that's a positive, net positive, and I think that's generally recognized. The sun doesn't shine 24 hours a day. That's not going to change, right? So how do we deal with that? Wind is a little, it's diurnal in different places. It has a profile, so the variability of that lowest cost electron is a reality. And so what's different now is if we're truly focused on reliability, affordability, sustainability, and equity, the economic piece, wind and solar are a big component of that. But now we've got to address the reliability component. And so this reality of more variability in the supply stack is now it's now requiring other changes in the markets. So to maintain the reliability component with assets that are now disparate. And so what is starting to happen, not as quickly as I think we'd like, is you've seen the evolution of storage technologies to complement that. The market rules to enable all of this are still, adapting. I think you're sitting there in Texas. We've been talking about real-time co-optimization for at least 5 years. It looks like it's on the horizon now. It's probably longer, but it looks like the end of 2025. The price signals and rules to enable storage, at least in the U.S. markets, not fully defined yet. Clearly, the price signals aren't. And so I do think that the demand side management, co-location, if we start thinking about the load growth, which hasn't happened in a decade plus in many places with electrification and the new AI and data center demand, the market rules are going to have to change. And for us to continue to find this balance of affordability, reliability, sustainability, and equity. And so I do think the time's different.
I think S-curves in technology and exponential cost reductions, like we've seen in solar panels, for example, are phenomenal forces of nature. And I think that particularly the S-curve in battery cell costs is actually brute forcing battery energy storage into places that none of us even imagined. And in order to, and which means that there's so many more batteries coming on the network than pretty much any of us thought 5-10 years ago. So the second order effect of that is pushing regulatory change to help these things make sense. And the beneficiary of that regulatory change and all the other things around it, as you talked about, also includes demand side, also includes flexibility. Because if it helps batteries, 9 out of 10 policy changes that help batteries also help flexibility and demand side response. So I think batteries are the force that is actually pushing through the changes required for demand side to really feel the economic, the advantages of being a large load or a large demand user and the flexibility around that. So I totally agree with you. Hey, you did talk then briefly around co-location. I know that you've been spending a lot of time on co-location. So let's just talk about that for a second. What's happening with co-location? Specifically around generation and load, which is a big topic. And in Europe, actually doesn't get talked about enough. But since being an Englishman in America, I've been surprised how much talk there is about co-locating load and generation.
Sure. No, it's a really good point. And it's very topical for the industry for a few reasons. So if you take a step back to, hey, we've got increased demand for electricity, kind of full stop, whether it's from demand, data centers, industrial load, reshoring, it's, electric vehicles, et cetera. The challenge we have in the U.S. markets, and I can't speak to Europe intelligently. I love Europe and used to work there briefly in the U.K., but I don't know the market so well anymore. So my comments I'll have to keep to U.S. Specifically. The challenge we have in the U.S. markets is that while the demand is growing, we have since World War II, we have aging infrastructure. We haven't reinvested in transmission in a material way. There's been bits and pieces here and there. We have retiring 50-year-old coal and thermal generation for either environmental or just economic reasons. We're trying to build more generation, whether it's thermal or renewables, or people are talking about nuclear and certainly gas, et cetera. The interconnection process, it can take 5 to 7 years. And so, you know, that's in the just on the supply side. And so we've got this challenge of the supply side not being able to ramp up quickly. Pretty much in all markets, ERCOT's a little faster in certain ways, but generally the most of the markets struggle with bringing things on faster just because of the process and the way the rules, how they bring things online. At the same time that you've got this massive growth that, you know, in some cases forecasting potentially 50% load increase or desire to do so, driven largely by data centers, but not only them. Certainly you've got large load growth in, certain areas around hydrogen and other industrial processes. But to meet those needs for electrons in just the current state, never mind a growth state, one of the ways you can do that, and this gets to co-location, the way they do it today, it's they run these studies in series, not in parallel. So if you're looking to bring a data center online, and I'm looking to bring a solar project or storage online, they don't get, and they happen to be near each other, they don't get studied independently. I'm sorry, they get studied independently, as opposed to if you come and say, hey, I've got a solar plant and I need the, I'm looking to do some behind the meter co-location for load that I can self-serve. So you need to really think about the net load and the impact on the transmission system. It allows the utilization of the existing transmission system to be more efficient and can allow some load to come online more quickly if you think about really from a net load perspective. That's sort of some of the background. The challenge is the rules and the processes don't exist. I'll be saying processes the rest of my life after this podcast. The processes.
You know what's funny though? Yeah, I think if you really want to be English, you'd say processes.
Processes. I'm really bastardizing it. I have to. Anyway, hopefully your listeners understand. But the processes or processes to bring load and generation online and think about it as a net impact to the system will allow a more efficient use of the system versus overbuilding it or taking a much longer period of time to bring these things online. The rules don't exist in place today to do that. And so there's a big push at the federal level with FERC. A lot of the industry is pushing to, hey, if we really want to move forward, we need to think about co-locating net impact to the system and have the rules in place to allow that.
There is another impact of that, which is, if I just think about nodal prices, for example, right? So you're priced at different locations on the network. What's a good example here? Say West Texas, right? In the panhandle where you've got tons of wind. I know you guys are active there. You've got tons of wind that is essentially some of the day getting zero or negative pricing because there's not enough load there. And you've got load that wants to be connected next to the wind because that's where all the abundant power is. But because they're not being studied at the same time, or the system studies are done, as you say, in sequence, not concurrently or not together, you could end up not putting load in the places as quick enough as you want, where you really want it. And then that would stimulate more demand and stimulate more wind in areas where there's already loads of wind.
That's a great example, Q. And I think the other thing where I thought you might go with it, the other, which I'm sort of glazing over here, the other change, or, you know, this is where rules and things have to be sorted out, how that load gets served in the incumbent utilities and load serving entities, it does change a bit of the contracting and stuff there. And so you, like most things, there's a little bit of resistance to people seeing that, perceiving that as a potential risk and things. So there are some other factors, but your point's correct. If we want to, you know, see in economic growth, which I think is always a positive thing, as long as it's done responsibly, how you develop, you know, make that happen, co-location around between load and generation is one way that can really, you know, address, help things happen in the next, you know, 5 years.
So you don't have to spend long on the internet to find stories of data centers or Bitcoin miners being co-located next to inefficient coal or open cycle gas, or things that from a engineering or molecule efficiency perspective, you probably wouldn't say is a great idea en masse. So Could you just talk about that for a second? What's happening with co-locating thermal assets with big loads?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, this is not, you know, the whole, I'm sure you've had or will have different discussions on cryptocurrency, so we're not going to go there. But you did see here in the last few years exactly what you're describing, where very nimble industrial load in the form of mining of Bitcoin were able to fairly quickly go to places where there was negative pricing or stranded electrons and go put their their Bitcoin mining operation located right next to that and capture those electrons. The difference between that, because they're very price elastic and sensitive, they can just shut off when prices spike. So the reality was they were basically at the wholesale level. And so they were exposed to the price spikes that you might see in ERCOT or any other market. And when those happen, they just shut down and it's just flip the switch. Most industrial operations, certainly data centers and the majority of the growth, and they aren't just flip a switch, hey, if prices go high, we're shut. And so it requires the co-location model looks more like a, how do you go behind the meter, have a higher level of predictability and a combination of not only maybe an intermittent resource or a thermal load, but also backup in the form of perhaps either batteries, or being able to go to the grid with for the 2% of the hours of the year that you might need to address running your facility, where today the there really isn't an option to do that. You're either a wholesale demand and you get charged for your full demand, and it economically just doesn't work. And so, you know, there's some other changes that will have to happen in the markets to not only allow this net load and treat it as net load, and then have the tariffs in place and the rules for the large loads to operate as a net load to the market, as opposed to a 200 megawatt load, 365 days a year.
So while I've got you on, I want to ask you about virtual PPAs, which is a term that's bandied around a lot, but means different things to different people. Could we just talk for a second about what a virtual PPA is and how you guys contract with them?
Sure. So as we talked about earlier, you know, historically, wholesale power was initially traded at the physical level. It was very, you know, you had to schedule the electrons from A to B, and it was a physical only. A virtual PPA is something that evolved in the last decade. And really, it's a financially settled transaction where two parties, in this case, if I'm a generator and you're the customer, we agree to a fix for floating swap and say, I'm going to deliver electrons to you, dear customer, into the market, and you're going to pay me, you know, $45 for each electron that may or may not have a REC. That's a whole other piece that might be embedded, you know, bundled in there or not. And then you're going to take the risk on the floating price. And so if for an hour, you're going to pay me $45 for an electron and the price happens to be $40, we're going to settle where actually it's a $5 settlement. What this does is it gives you a hedge of, hey, my guaranteed costs are $45. It's not going to go above that. For me, gives me a certainty I'm getting at least $45 for my electron as long as I produce it. So the VPPA structure was an elegant financial way for parties to transact. What it introduced, and this is the back to kind of evolution, it introduced something that's very in the U.S. markets and maybe in the Europe as well, in certain cases, this concept of basis risk. So historically, then that settlement for that fixed for floating swap, you're probably not going to do that at the project node. It's just too volatile and just from a marking of the market, et cetera. And so you normally do that at a hub. Well, now you're introducing this concept of basis risk between the hub and the actual node and the value of the power, the power being produced at the node of your project versus the hub where you're settling. And so that basis risk has become really a very complicated and important part, and in some cases complicated, part of the managing of the risk on who has that and how you manage it. You used the example earlier of West Texas. So West Texas, for those who don't know, very famous for having lots of cows, lots of oil and gas, and lots of wind. And solar, actually. Not a lot of people, not a lot of load, although that's changing. So you have massive amounts of generation in that area. If you try to move that power to a hub, the value of that power at the node gets discounted because there's only so much that can flow through because of the laws of physics through the existing transmission lines. And so the value of that electron at the node is lower than it is at the hub. And as you get more and more wind and solar and no new generation in that area, that basis widens. And so basis risk becomes a very important part of understanding where you put generation and assets. That's why you've seen a lot of storage, and I know you guys are familiar with this, storage opportunities to go and help manage where you get these very localized situations where you can manage some of this volatility. So if it's low pricing or negative, I'd love to get paid to charge a battery, you know, where it's actually negative pricing. Someone's going to pay me to take those, and then I can inject those electrons in the future. So that's where you've seen a use case in the last couple of years of batteries to help manage that dynamics in the power system.
You've talked a lot there about basis risk. And just a comment, really, that in Europe, we're talking a lot about how to move to locational pricing of some sort. And of course, in the US, there's lots of nodal markets. And it, as somebody who's seen both, it just blows my mind how cool nodal markets are, I mean, I must say. But then there's these second order effects of locational pricing, such as basis risk, that, as you say, have been around in commodity markets for basically forever, but we haven't really got used to them in power markets. And they create all sorts of complicated phenomena to manage later down the line. And so just a note for our European listeners who are, you know, we're in Great Britain, we're arguing about whether zonal or nodal or something else, and it looks like zonal is where we're headed. And how you slice the pie locationally has a huge impact on not just, you know, how many prices you have, but the relationship between those prices and then all of these contracts that sit on top of it. So we could see a lot more talk about basis risk in Europe in the decades to come.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. And maybe you are absolutely correct. And I think as people are thinking about market design and how you then manage commercially in those markets, those are really important. Basis risk has, you know, in the commodities has existed for a long time, but to your point, you know, the market structures and the nodal markets in Europe aren't in that at that stage today. I have a funny story. If we got a minute here, I'll share it just to highlight basis risk.
Yeah, for sure. Do it.
Around 2006, I was on the power desk here, and you know the markets were kind of evolving. We had, you know, the PJM, ISO, SPP were all, ERCOT were all functioning. I remember having a conversation with the company who exists today, who you, all your listeners would know. I won't mention them, but I saw they had applied for a wholesale power markets license. And it was a technology company. I found the phone number, got it, called the guy, and I said, "Hey, what are you doing? Why are you in the power markets? Like, I don't understand why you have a wholesale power market." I said, "Oh, well, we have this technology and we have exposure to the market. So we think we got to understand it. And so there's some wind farms and we're buying some power there. And we have some load in another state." And I said, "Oh, wow, that's interesting. How do you manage basis risk?" And he said, "What's basis risk?" So they had literally signed a 25-year contract as a hedge to their energy. Again, they were pretty flush with cash. Had no idea like what they were getting into. And so it, you know, like every industry, as things evolve, you know, it's really important to think through that, as you mentioned, these, you know, changes have real impacts to the markets and risk. And you, as a market participant, it's really important to understand those. I think that's a really good point, Q. And I think, you know, whether you talk about zonal or locational nodal pricing, it will change because, you know, nodal is just a larger segment than the nodes. You can have basis between locations. You will have, you know, differences. And so, yeah, how those markets and how people manage in them will change, which is interesting.
If you're listening to this in Europe, we need to talk about basis risk more in this whole REMA or otherwise conversation in Europe. Anyway, so now to my two favorite questions. The first one is your chance to plug something. So if there's anything you want to tell our audience who tends to be European and American and Australian battery bods, this is your chance. And then the second question to tee you up is about your contrarian view. But firstly, what do you want to tell us about?
So I think a couple things that come to mind, too. I think particularly for mature markets and economies. And it kind of mentioned this earlier, you know, kind of post-World War II, we've had a lot of investment in infrastructure that's aging. And so the reinvestment in new generation, regardless of what the technology is necessary. And particularly around transmission, there is no energy transition without investment in transmission. And if you were going to make a t-shirt, you know, no transition without transmission would be what I would put on that. And I think in this market, we're starting to see that the recognition of that being driven by the challenges of you know, demand not being able to get online and how do we address that. As it relates to, I think, batteries specifically, to your point, the role for batteries, I think, in each market is going to look different and is going to continue to evolve as you used, I think, so eloquently, the S-curve kind of a technology curve reference earlier. As those costs come down, where storage plays a role or can play a role in the generating stack and at the transmission level or co-located, those use cases are changing and will continue to evolve. The challenge is the market rules and policies need to enable investments in those sorts of technologies. So I participate in conferences and, you know, different industry things, I always encourage people, you know, what are you going to do about it? Like, it's one thing to say, oh, you know, getting involved and in the industries and making those policy changes happen is really important. Because if you don't, you know, if you individually or as organizations or companies don't advocate for those things, then who's going to? So I think it's really, you know, the call to action is, hey, if you're in this space and you happen to be in the battery energy storage system space and whatever market you operate in, the market rules need to support and enable the value that that technology can bring that need to be there. Otherwise, it's going to be difficult to make those investments and bring them forward. So that would be sort of my friendly call to action, if you will.
All right. And how about your contrarian view? What's the thing that you believe that you reckon not a lot of other people believe?
So I know this is supposed to be focused on energy, and I'll come to that in a minute. I'm going to go out on a limb and say Nottingham to win the EPL this year is probably pretty contrarian. Not as contrarian as it is in most years, but I think they have a chance sitting to where they sit today. So all kidding aside, though, good luck to them, but having a good run. As much as I believe in AI load growth, and I do, I question whether it's as massive as it's being projected. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One is if sort of historical, and you alluded to it, I've been around a little longer than you, but in 2000, we had the dot-com bubble, you know, and everything was going to be dot-com XYZ and a bit of a collapse there and you know, Enron and WorldCom, it kind of got wrapped up into that for different reasons. I remember vividly in 2008, oil, and I'll never forget, in April of 2008, Goldman was calling for oil to go to $200 a barrel. that it was about 160 at the time. They literally called for $100 a barrel right when it hit its peak at 160. And what really was happening, this goes back to really understanding the industry, China had a massive commodities run up to the Beijing Olympics. The Olympics were happening in summer of 2008. They basically shut everything down because of the smog. And so in April, when Goldman was calling for $200 a barrel, it basically peaked at 160 and ended up almost at, I think it was a tenth of that a year later. I think it almost went negative at one point at Cushman. So you have things that cycle. We had the polar vortex here in the US, and you had Uri, you had the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. There's going to be unpredictable things. I'm not arrogant enough to sit here and say, you know, or dystopian enough to say what's going to happen in the next 5 years, because things that neither of us know are going to happen or will happen and impact the market materially. AI load growth will have an impact. I just am not sure it's, you know, the 2x growth that they're talking about. I think when your grandmother starts talking about AI and the taxi driver and everyone else, you start to wonder if it's a little bit overcooked. And I, while I believe in it, I think they'll get more efficient. And so I think there's growth there. Maybe it's half of what they're projecting, so it's still meaningful, but I think that might fall into the contrarian bucket. So I'll leave it there.
As you say, yeah, when you're a taxi driver, or what was that phrase? Is it, there's that famous phrase to do with the Wall Street crash in the 1920s, isn't there? When you're like your shoe shiner or something is telling you the stocks to pick, you're in trouble. Something like that.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, it does feel like we're in one of them, doesn't it? That's for sure. So, all right, John, just want to say, always lovely to speak to you. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. And I hope it gets a bit warmer where you are now. It looks absolutely freezing. I should have started with that.
We are below zero Fahrenheit today here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So it's a winter wonderland and very cold out there. I will see you in Austin soon. I will be.
Oh, you will? Yeah, yeah. I'll see you. Are you coming to the ERCOT summit?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Well, actually, I should be talking about this as well. My turn to plug. If you're coming to the ERCOT Summit, Modo Energy is doing a big drinks and celebrations and general networking hangout bonanza afterwards. So if you haven't found out about that yet, you should come down and come see us. Even if you're not going to the summit, if you're in Austin, Texas, come and see us. It's going to be a blast. John, thank you very much. I'm going to see you in a couple of weeks' time. And until then.
Cheers. Thank you.